with Noel Debien on ABC Local Radio.
Good to be with you. This evening we've got 2 hours of really quite diverse titillation for you, I've got to say. In our second hour we'll be looking at, I hope you've seen some of the stuff about the Gaby Baby film. It's been going off in Victoria and New South Wales, and I'm sure it's sort of leaked over into Western Australia and into the north. That's about a film about families. It's a little film about families raising children, but same-sex families. It's been banned in New South Wales state schools. It's been a big furore. It's been mentioned in two parliaments. And we have the filmmaker, plus also a member of New South Wales Legislative Assembly, joining us in the second hour to talk a bit about, well, the hullabaloo about that and the pros and cons of the thing. But the filmmaker, Maya Newell, will join us. But we also have joining us somebody who can tell us a bit more about the Royal Commission on Sexual Abuse, because there was some pretty important testimony given on Monday of this last week past. And that's in about an hour's time. There's also the quiz, all the sorts of things that you enjoy in the program, but lots of diversity tonight. Now, in this first hour, though, if you're a Melburnian and you've had, or you were almost going to get your papers checked, you know what it can feel like to be on Hogan's Heroes, no doubt. And there has been some talk about national security. And, of course, it's been in all the press. But, of course, earlier this week, there was discussion of striking, of bombing Syria. And it's turned out that there is some serious discussion going on between the United States and Australia, and our troops look like they're going there. And we thought it was a good time to talk about the ethics of war. And we have an absolutely stellar panel for you, who I'm going to introduce you to in a moment. But first, a little music from the Divine Miss M to get us in the mood.
From a distance, the world looks blue and green, and the snow-capped mountains white. From a distance, the ocean meets the stream, and the eagle takes to flight. It's the voice of every man. From a distance, we all have enough, and no one is in need. Well,
we could have the whole of Miss Divine M's song, and I really sort of want to, but there's so much to talk about, and I think we just have to stop with her saying, from a distance, you look like my friend, because there are heavy issues at stake. We've heard a proposal for Australian airstrikes against forces in Syria. Bombs on the ground, people dying. We've been involved in the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, East Timor, Bosnia-Herzegovina, many places when you think about it, and don't forget the Solomons for peacekeeping. Keith, you can correct me in a moment. I saw you shake your head. One of them we weren't involved in, clearly.
I don't think we got involved in Bosnia.
Good. There you go. It's all very real, and tonight we want to talk about real, except Bosnia. We're not talking about that. And what is just war? Why involve ourselves? Why send our forces into harm's way? We have a rather illustrious panel for you. Dr. Keith Suter is an economic and social commentator. He's a strategic planner, a conference speaker, broadcaster, regular on Australian radio, member of the Club of Rome, one of the world's great intellectuals, and a specialist on this area. Welcome, Keith.
Thanks very much indeed.
And in our Melbourne studios, Dean Peter Baker. Now, Peter's been writing on this subject. He's a senior lecturer in the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at the UNSW in Canberra and a researcher in military ethics in the Australian Centre for the Study of Armed Conflict in Society. Now, there's some heavy qualification. Dean Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And in our Brisbane studios, Harlem Rain. Harlan is an associate professor of Islamic West Relations in the School of Humanities at Griffith University and formerly worked for the Australian Government Department of Immigration. And he's very engaged with these issues, including other issues, though, of migration, settlement, integration through teaching and research. Halim, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Now, I want to begin with something that the philosopher A.C. Grayling said. Now, this was from Lateline, and this was a bit of a shock because this guy's a bit of a pacifist. He doesn't believe in war, and here's what he said.
I mean, those of us who have humanitarian impulses, who would like to see things done by negotiation, we're very uneasy about the use of things like bombing or like putting troops on the ground.
But this is a surprising thing because I guess you are essentially here making a humanist case for war against religious fundamentalists who effectively define decadent Western culture as evil and therefore pose a kind of existential threat.
Yes, indeed. But of course, in the argument over religion, the weapons that humanists use are the weapons of argument and of reason and of evidence. And this is a very different story. But here, I think we've really gone, you know, there's a tipping point has been passed now. And we've got concrete evidence provided to us by ISIS themselves that they are an extremely toxic problem.
Could you imagine making an argument or being forced because of the nature of ISIS to make an argument for putting boots on the ground to actually have a war with them?
Yes, I can. This is a difficult one because there's always black and white in people's minds about these sorts of situations. But if you go back to the massacre in Rwanda, Burundi, you may remember between the Tutsis and the Hutus, at that time, people were saying, we should have gone in there, we should have gone and stopped this. There should have been, in effect, a kind of military police action to stop it. When the Kosovo crisis blew up in the Balkans, people said, we've got to go in there and stop this because there's wholesale massacre. And in those cases, I think there was a genuine argument to say, those polities which have the competence and which have the authority, which can project that degree of policing force, really had a responsibility to go and help the people who were under the cosh. In the case of Iraq, it was a completely different story. That was a terrible miscalculation, and it was done on the basis of very, very poor intelligence, if indeed there was intelligence at all. I mean, we really have made a mess, and can we really leave the people in the region to clean the mess up themselves, given the way it's panning out at the moment?
And they have A.C. Grayling. Now, that's a great mind, one of the world's great minds, saying, you know, maybe we should go in. Now, before I go to each of our panellists to talk very specific things, I do want to ask very generally to each of you. Keith Suter, what do you make of what A.C. Grayling just said? Syria?
Well, he did cover a lot of things overall, and I'm not that clear about whether he's actually arguing in favour of having boots on the ground in Syria and Iraq. My own view is that I agree with him in the sense that some of the mess that we see in Iraq today is due to that invasion in 2003, and that was a terrible mistake by the US, UK and Australia to go in. We ought to have a responsibility to look after the refugees that are fleeing from it, 2 million people, and I think we ought to be putting much more money into that region to look after the refugees. Rather than putting boots on the ground, we should be looking after the refugees themselves.
Foreign aid, you say?
Foreign aid and disaster relief, and in big time, you know, a lot of money for that. I don't think you're going to gain very much by sending in the troops. The last time we did that, or the West, that is, not Australia, was in Libya with the same sort of argument. We've got to stop this terrible massacre that Colonel Gaddafi was going to do in Benghazi. Mm. NATO then went in, bombed to prevent this from happening, triggered this civil war within Libya, and now it's got even worse because Benghazi is likely to end up as the Islamic State's foothold on the North African coast.
Dean Baker, what's your response to Grady? He does sound as if he's saying boots on ground, it's time in Syria. What's your response to what he says?
Yeah, he does. Well, look, he's... he's perhaps deliberately unclear because it's a very unclear situation. I think for me what's interesting is that here you have someone who is by intuition pacifist, and yet here is a situation where he's saying, look, under these kinds of extreme circumstances, violence may actually be necessary. And I think that in a way encapsulates what the principles of just war theory are all about. Mm. It's the sympathy with the pacifist view that war is a bad thing, it's something we should avoid as much as possible. But under some circumstances, justice cries out.
We're going to come to each of that. We just lost that line, I think, actually. Halim, can I go to you? We're just going to check on our line, which seems to have just gone a bit dull there. Halim Rain, you heard AC growling. Mm-hmm. He seems to be saying boots on ground. This is an area of yours too. How does he strike you? How do you respond to what he just said?
Look, in certain circumstances, boots on the ground might be effective, and it might be what is necessary to protect the people who are most vulnerable in some of these situations. And I know we'll come to it tonight, but I think a different discussion is about bombing campaigns. And I think that what's needed at the moment is for us to reflect and learn from the mistakes that we've made in the past and try to avoid making them again in the future.
Look, thank you. Now, what I do want to, if we can negotiate in the next, 40 minutes, I would like to talk about just war theory, because just war theory is, there is an equivalent in Islam, and Halim, you're going to help us with that. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely an equivalent. But let's begin with some things that might be surprising. Dean Peter Baker, I've spent the weekend reading your book. In draft, I haven't seen the pictures, but I've read the book, right. And it's very helpful. And you actually begin it, though, by saying that when you introduce yourself as a military ethicist, people joke, isn't that an oxymoron?
Yes, I get it a lot. Well, I don't think it is. So, if you were an absolute pacifist, then I guess that kind of makes sense. But for the military profession is fairly unique in having such a vast is probably too strong a word, but a very well-structured ethical framework. Mm. And it's a unique ethical framework that just doesn't have an equivalent in other professions, the medical profession.
You took me back years,
so
absolutely. As I was reading it, you were saying it's the only major human undertaking which has an ethical tradition established purely for itself, military ethics, the ethics of war.
Yeah, so it's really unique in that, and it's a very rich tradition. So, and we talk about just war theory, but really it's the just war tradition, mm-hmm. Because there are differences within that tradition. It goes back a long way, and as Halim is going to say, that it's not just a Western tradition either. There are different branches that feed into it from other traditions as well.
Well, I'd like to begin by unpacking the West one, just because it took me back 25 years, to theology studies of having to study. I think Thomas Aquinas was the just war theory that I studied. But let's begin with that. I mean, and let's just keep Syria in mind. Let's just take Syria as an example, but we might want to talk about other incidences we've been involved in. There are sort of conditions. There are seven conditions. Let's begin going through them. Right intention. Right intention. Keith Suter, how do you apply right intention in a war? What does that mean to you?
Well, I think the theory behind the just war idea is that you use violence as a last resort. You've actually got two ways of looking at it. One is actually going to war, and the secondly, how you actually conduct the war.
Yes.
Right? So you have restrictions on the use of force in international disputes. That's banned, which is why some of us regard the invasion in 2003 as being illegal. And Bush, Blair and Howard as unindicted war criminals. Mm. So you've got the limitation on actually using the force in the first place. And then when you do go in, then there are very strict limitations. I might say the Australian Defence Force has got some of the best law of armed conflict training in the world. Mm. We are pioneers in this. And that restricts the where you can drop bombs, what are regarded as appropriate targets, how you're to treat prisoners of war, etc. So they're the two major strands. And then, as I say, you've got things like having appropriate authority, appropriate justification, also a clear idea that you're going to be doing good. And the worry that some of us have got, that the situation in Syria at the moment is so confused, you don't know if you're going to end up doing better. Well, certainly we didn't do that in Libya. Not us, but NATO has not improved. The West.
When we say us, I'm thinking us, as in the Western alliances.
Right. Yeah.
Dean, can I bring you in there?
Yep.
Another of those in the tradition is a reasonable chance of success.
Yeah, which is very important. I just want to jump back, though, onto the proper authority and the right intention thing, because what we have to be careful with is intention and motive, and that's getting muddled up, I think, in the discussion at the moment. The question of, you know, why is the Prime Minister wanting to do this and that kind of thing. That's a question of motive. That should be separate from intention, which is about what we intend to go and do if we do go and intervene. So we can do our intention could be the right thing for all sorts of different motives, and that's important to separate those things out. But coming back to likelihood
of success. I disclosed, by the way, that I studied just war theory beside the Prime Minister when we were in theology, too. I disclosed
there you go.
That. Yeah. I was there when he heard it, so I know that he understands it quite well.
There you go, exactly. Yeah. Likelihood of success is very important. So some of the principles of the just war tradition are deontological in their nature. They're about principle, you know, this is what the right thing to do is, but some of them look at consequences. And likelihood of success, the idea is simply that, look, you can have justification for getting involved in war, but if you're unlikely to actually achieve some positive goal in doing that, then all you're doing is adding to the suffering.
War is not justified, in other words.
Exactly.
According to that rule. Well, just to run through them quickly, it should be a last resort. There should be a proportionality of the ends. There should be a reasonable chance of success. It should be decided on the right authority. It should be publicly declared, is the traditional theory. Now, Halim, can I go to you? Does that list of seven things have an equivalent in Islamic jurisprudence and thought?
Yeah, I think to the surprise of many listeners, that list is very similar in the Islamic perspective. I would say that in the Islamic perspective, you could probably sum up the main objectives into three, and they are that fighting should be done, or the use of armed force should be in the case of self-defense. It should be overcoming for the purpose of overcoming some kind of oppression. And the third reason is to establish some kind of a just peace. So war shouldn't be, or fighting shouldn't be, an end in itself. It should be a means to an end. And that end should be the establishment of some kind of just peace.
Well, it certainly sounds closely parallel, doesn't it? Islamic Christian traditions certainly do. Keith, can I go to you? ISIS. Now, this seems to me a wild card in all things, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. And
Daesh. Let's say Daesh.
Well, no, let's not, because you're playing the government's games.
Right.
It calls itself Islamic State, plus a number of other things. I think we should call it by that. Daesh is actually a propaganda term, which is being used by the Americans and now Australians. So it's a play on words with the spelling of how you spell Daesh. So the Islamic State, I take seriously the viewpoint of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the currently self-proclaimed caliph, who says there's only one way to God. I think he's right, except he's on the wrong road. I'm a Methodist, so I've got my own clear views.
Well, you could go over and have a chat, I suppose, but I don't think you'd get
very far. No, you wouldn't get very far. And I think what you've got to realise is that you've got a group that knows how to play the media game. 10 years ago, he published a book on the internet saying that we need a theatre of terrorism. In other words, that we will carry out public executions. They do it at a place called Dubek, which is where the final Armageddon is to take place, not at Megiddo, but up in Syria, at a place called Dubek, which will be where we will see the clash between Islam and Rome. So there's a lot of thinking that's gone into this, and the way, of course, that he manipulates the Western media. And my fear is that if you have boots on the ground, or indeed for that matter an Australian pilot shot down, you'll end up with a public execution, and then suddenly, you know, the mood
in
Australia will change.
There'll be no rationality at all.
No.
No rationality at all. Well, Dean, can I ask you, now, the Islamic State seems to be a wild card in all this. I mean, we look at outrage, we look at Palmyra being destroyed, we look at public executions, we look at gay men being pushed off buildings. We look at Muslim clerics arrested and killed and beheaded for not agreeing with the particular ISIS view. We've seen endless numbers of people die in a miserable way. How do you measure that against just war? You know,
well, there's no doubt that the atrocities that ISIS is committing meet the requirements for just cause. But that's why we have all these other requirements as well. So I don't think anyone thinks that that what they're doing should be allowed and they should continue to do it. It's certainly atrocious, literally. So it meets any kind of intervention certainly meets the just cause requirement. The real challenges come in with these other requirements of things like likelihood of success. That's where the real challenge comes in.
Now, Dr. Keith Suter has brought up a very important issue, though, which is media, the theatre of the whole thing. And it seems that ISIS is very interested in the theatre of things. That's what terrorism is. You cause one thing to happen which harms a small number of people, but terrorises a great group, and you do it publicly, don't you?
That's right. You kill one and scare a million.
Yes.
That's the essence of it. And for that, you've got to have the cooperation of the media. So there is no terrorism in North Korea or in the old Soviet Union because there was no free media. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Thatcher said 30 years ago that the media give oxygen to the terrorists. Because if you look at the heightened state of anxiety in this country, in fact, the average Australian stands a greater chance of being killed by a shark than by a terrorist. But I get people who stop me in the street, who see me in the mornings after the TV, and they just say, well, when are we going to be attacked by the terrorists? There is that heightened level of anxiety. Yeah. And then to have a prime minister saying the Islamic State's coming to get us, I think Islamic State probably have difficulty finding this on the map. But it adds to that public anxiety, which means it goes back to the point that Dean was making earlier about intention and motive. My worry is the Prime Minister playing the security card as a way of bumping up his own status?
In politics.
Mm. All politics is local.
You sound concerned, Keith Suter.
Well, I am, because I think we could end up stumbling into yet another conflict and make yet another mistake. Some of the mentioned in your introduction, you did that survey and you mentioned East Timor, Timor-Leste now. Brilliant work that we've done. The Solomon Islands, Ramsey.
Great success.
Great success. But then when we go right out of area operations, such as we've seen in Iraq in 2003, then we start to go wrong. We should be seeing ourselves as the regional sheriff and looking after our region. We've got enough problems in this region to look after.
Well, Halim, can I come to you? When we say local sheriff, that of course means the Pacific area.
Pacific, yeah.
But then again, of course, since certainly the 1970s, our immigration policies is such that we have many Syrians here, we have many Lebanese, we have many people who have families in these zones. So, Halim, do we actually owe this region some sort of help, in your view?
Well, I think we do. I think we owe help to the Middle East region. I mean, starting with the people of Iraq, we were involved in the initial war against Iraq from the 1990s, and then again in 2003. So I think we do owe some level of support to people in the region. However, if we're talking about bombing campaigns, I mean, the statistics tell us that they haven't been particularly successful.
Well, we've been watching Gaza too. I think people are shocked by Gaza.
Absolutely. I mean, if we look at the situation in the Gaza Strip, we can see an almost annual bombing of the people of Palestine by Israel that results in thousands of deaths. The overwhelming majority are civilians, and I think in the most recent conflict or the most recent attack, a third of those were children. So I think what we need to be talking about here is the use of indiscriminate weapons like bombs and their lack of effectiveness.
So the means of prosecution of war, the proportionality of ends and the means that are used to achieve those ends is what you're talking about.
Well, that is an important part of the discussion of just war.
Well, let's go back. Dean, can I ask you, this is an obvious question, when we discovered that apparently it was our government that said, would you like us to come and help you bomb, as opposed to the Americans inviting us, there is an argument that, from some Australians that, we follow the American line, that our ally is our ally, we'll do whatever we can to assist our ally. Do we need to be worried about that as we're talking about the justice of war, or should we be following American foreign policy essentially as our ally?
Well, I think ultimately we are responsible for what we choose to do. So it can't be an excuse that we're in an alliance and we're cooperating with the alliance. If the alliance is doing what the alliance shouldn't be doing, then we shouldn't be doing it either. So that, I think that's part of it. But on the other hand, with these kinds of situations, you can describe the situation differently, but in many respects, the reason for us to get involved is humanitarian. And with these kinds of humanitarian engagements, that's being the goal. Whether we're successful is a separate question. There is a kind of moral impetus on us because we are one of the wealthiest nations, per capita in the world. We have capabilities when operating along with the US as a partner. So there is a kind of moral push there that those who can intervene should. On the other hand, the question is, can we, by intervening, actually do good? And that comes back to Halim's point that if the bombing isn't actually helping, if it is just causing more damage, then that is going against the proportionality requirement.
Keith Suter, can I come back to you? The declaration of war. Now, it seems to me that doesn't really happen anymore, does it?
No, it's banned by Article 2.4 of the UN Charter. So in 1945, war was outlawed.
Thank God for that.
That's right. So, which is why technically we refer to conflicts rather than wars. So it is now illegal for one country to declare war on another.
Lord.
Now, if you go back, it's the Middle Ages. That's where the declarations began. One knight charging another on a tournament field. So your squire would sound the alarm that the knight was coming down towards to hit the other knight. Then, and of course, the Japanese had great difficulty ever remembering to declare wars. So in 1945, in the UN Charter...
That was a reference to Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. In 1945, when they drew up the UN Charter, Article 2.4 builds on an earlier provision after World War I, but a much stronger one, saying you must not use the force or threaten to use force in international politics, Article 2.4 of the UN Charter. So technically, you would not expect now any country to declare a war in any other. A very small example of this.
They just have conflicts, as you're saying.
That's right. And also another change is that when I left school in 1964, I joined the War Office in London. There are now no war offices around the world.
They're defence offices, aren't they?
Departments of Defence.
Of course
exactly.
They are.
No
yes.
longer do we have war offices.
Yeah, of course, and everybody's a defence person because they're defending.
Exactly.
That's what they're doing. They're not making war. Now, Halim, is that registering any bells for you?
Is what in particular?
Well, the idea that we don't have wars anymore, and apparently what's happening with ISIS is a conflict.
Well, I mean, we're all sitting here smiling. You can't see me, but we're all, you know, we're sitting here thinking, well, you can call it war, you can call it conflict, but we all know what the consequences are.
Yeah.
And the people who are, you know, the millions of refugees know it better than all three of us or four of us.
Could I just clarify that, sure. In fact, what it's worth bearing in mind is if you have a look at the number of conflicts being fought since 1900 or since 1950, really, we've seen a decline. The most dangerous time to live between 1900 and today would have been 1900 to 1950, the outbreak of the Korean War. Since 1950, we've had a decline in the number of conflicts and a decline in the number of people being killed. The world is actually becoming a more peaceful place. Now, I agree you've got more refugees because what you're seeing is the breakup of the existing nation states. But
right.
It's now very rare for one country to invade another. So the world is actually becoming more peaceful. It's called the liberal theory of world peace. So in other words, that as you get more democracies in the world, as you get more foreign trade, so it knits the countries together. And in democracies, people would much rather spend money than go to war. And leaders themselves do better by improving the economy rather than seeking to win military glory, which was Napoleon's problem. He had to keep on winning wars. So there has been a change. So you were previously, I think, a little dismissive about Ministry of Defence and the UN Charter, but we have actually seen a change. War is no longer as useful. What we're looking at now is complex irregular
yes.
warfare, which is much more difficult to fight. The problem is we still have defence departments that operate in the belief that we're going to have another big war with conventional forces. Increasingly, it's Islamic State and others, and it's more difficult to fight.
Halim, you want to come in there?
Yeah, if I could just come in. I mean, I think we have to just trace a little bit of modern history here and go back to, you know, the initial invasion of Iraq, which was a consequence of Iraq's occupation of Kuwait, which was a consequence of the Iran-Iraq war. And we have to think about some of the motivations that took place that led to those events occurring. And it had everything to do with economics. It had everything to do with certain corporations within the United States and some of which in the UK who saw their economic advantage to be gained by the invasion and occupation of Iraq. There was no connection between Iraq and the events of 9/11, but very soon after that event, you know, plans were drawn up for a subsequent invasion of Iraq. It had nothing to do with...
That was to get their weapons of mass destruction, you'll recall.
Well, yeah, but as we also recall, no weapons of mass destruction were found, and we have, you know, lots of records to
Keith
inform us.
Keith is nodding furiously here. Keith is nodding furiously, Harley.
Yeah. That those weapons were destroyed in the 1990s and didn't exist in 2003.
Can I say that the reason I was looking a bit nonplussed as we were talking about there's no war anymore was all I could think was the John Cleese dead parrot routine. That is a dead parrot. No, sir, it's not. And in the sense that you could look at something like Bosnia-Herzegovina and that was ugly, yes, but it was finally brought under some sort of control and there was some sort of agreement between bodies. But if you looked at Rwanda and what happened there, was that a war? What was it? You know, it was a huge racial conflict that was all over the place and the UN was all over the place in the middle of it. And now we're looking at ISIS again. And I'm just a layman, you know, I'm no expert in this. But looking at ISIS, it's like there's such brutality and that brutality is meted out to anybody. It doesn't matter if you're a Muslim cleric, if you're a Syrian Christian, if you're a Lebanese, if you're a Yazidi, if you're a Jew. If you don't agree with ISIS, there is no reasoning here, Keith Sitter, is there?
Exactly it. And they've got a very clear interpretation of the Quran. And so they, in fact, see as number one in terms of their targets the Shia. So here you've got Sunni, who are continuing a 1,300-year-old civil war, which is another reason why I'm reluctant to get involved in the Middle East. We're stepping into a fast-flowing river.
Which we
don't understand. That becomes quite obvious in 2003. And let me just say, in fairness to the intelligence agencies, because my guess is the intelligence agencies were giving good advice to Bush, Blair and Howard, and they all found reasons to ignore it. In Great Britain, we've had this very great soul-searching going on, the Chilcot Inquiry, to find out how on earth the British went to war for no good reason. In Australia, we just figured that Howard was a liar. You shrug your shoulders, you move on. In the United States, Obama would not investigate the errors of 2003. But in the UK, there is this investigation. The problem is the report is so explosive, they still haven't published it. It's rolled on for years, and they're always finding reasons to delay. But it's called the Chilcot Inquiry, and it's the intelligence community have made it quite clear they are not going to accept the blame for 2003. They tried to give honest advice to the government. Blair chose to ignore them and be guided by Bush, who was himself ignoring the Arabists in the State Department who were saying, don't get involved.
Halim, can I ask you, that Shia-Sunni divide thing, how real is that? For those of us who are not Muslims, who don't actually understand it, I can't tell you how many times Muslim friends have told me Sunnis and Shias are one. There is no difference. And they've said it emphatically to me here in Australia. And so I have to say I was a little suspicious at how emphatically they said it.
Sure.
But how important is that to this conflict we're talking about, as Keith has just said?
It's very important to this conflict. I mean, this is the reason why Iran is involved on one particular side, Saudi Arabia is involved on the other side. But, you know, I think what's important to note is that what is the difference between a Sunni and a Shia? And fundamentally, the difference has nothing to do with religion. The difference is political. Essentially, the difference is relates to what Sunnis and Shias believe about leadership and succession.
About the caliphs, the descendants of the Prophet on the one hand.
Which is another very important point. I mean, this whole idea of caliphate has actually nothing to do with the religion of Islam. This is an invention of Sunnis in the 11th century to try to compete with the Shia idea of the imamate. So the Shias essentially believe that the one who is most legitimate to lead the Muslim community or state, if you like, is the one who's from the lineage of the Prophet Muhammad and specifically from the lineage of Ali and Fatima, his daughter. The Sunnis believe that, you know, anyone who is of a particular standing within the community and has the support of people is the one who can rightfully lead. So the differences between the two have nothing to do with the religion per se. They have everything to do with politics.
Is that entirely true, though? Because I've heard of 12ers and 7ers, and Shias visit shrines. In fact, I think of Shias as sort of Roman Catholic Muslims, as opposed to Sunnis being sort of Protestant Muslims who are not into shrines and stuff. You know what I mean?
Well, no one would deny the religious overtones, but at the end of the day, I mean, the fundamental ideas here relate to politics. And I think the major challenge that Islam has today is to disentangle itself from politics that has been there ever since the death of the Prophet Muhammad, when the first Arab empire was created by the first caliph. His name was Abu Bakr. And then you had this succession of four caliphs, according to the Sunni perspective, that ruled up until 661.
I recall it,
And during this period, you actually had the emergence of a group that looks very similar to groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS that we see today. Extremist groups that declare all others who don't subscribe to their particular perspective to be non-Muslims and, as a consequence of that, legitimate targets of their violence. I mean, they were the ones that actually assassinated the fourth Caliph, who was the the cousin of the Prophet Muhammad.
Now, it's really interesting, you know, as a layman, to hear you talk about that, I have to say, Alim, because it gives a completely different perspective on what might be happening in the Middle East at the moment. But, Dean, can I bring you back? Because part of your book, you talk about different ways, different ethical ways of dealing with war and let's call it conflict from now on, given we don't have war anymore, talking about conflict. But one of the things you talked about was utilitarianism as a way of looking at stuff. Now, if we took that theory of utilitarianism, you know, the either the greatest possible good for the greatest possible number, or the least amount of suffering for the greatest number of people, could we apply it in this particular Syrian situation and get anywhere?
We could certainly have a go. I think what's great about just war theory is that it doesn't kind of grab hold of any one of the there's sort of three main approaches to ethics in general. One is the consequences-based approach, which is includes utilitarianism. Mm. One is your principles-based approach, so Kant,
virtue, and stoicism, and all that.
And
sort
then virtue is your third. And and what just war theory does is actually incorporate key elements of all three of those, which to me makes it a pretty well-rounded approach to things. So if we only thought about the greatest happiness for the greatest number, that seems like an obvious thing that we should aim at. The trouble with that on a kind of fairly shallow approach is that it tends to suggest that you can sacrifice the good of the few for the good of the many. And there are some circumstances where perhaps that is appropriate, but we don't always want to jump into that. And so we think that there should be some principles that we hold
in effect
to.
We do that in war, though, don't we? If we target somewhere to bomb it and kill, if our forces, our defense forces, do that and say, we're taking out that center, we are literally saying we will kill those 20 people because we're going to save. We're actually tolerating the death of some people, which within, you know, the theory of certainly Christian ethics, is a little difficult to argue that you are using the means of killing to save others. It's a little difficult to argue.
It is, and it's been a long-standing discussion back to Augustine and Aquinas, but the idea is, look, if the circumstances are serious enough, if we've met those principles that we have a just cause, we have proper authority, and so on, then for us to be able to actually go and do something with the incredible complexity and messiness that war is, we are going to have to accept that war is an imprecise tool, and that some deaths that we don't desire, that we don't intend, may well occur. And that's where that proportionality calculation
comes
in.
Well, there are times when I look at just war theory as if I look like it's a whitewashing of an entirely disorganized human undertaking, otherwise known as war.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like a way of whitewashing it sometimes to me. There are some people waiting to call. 1-300-800-222 is our number. 1-300-800-222. You may have a question or an observation for a very eminent panel here. With me in studio, Dr. Keith Suter. Now, Keith is an economic and social commentator. He's the foreign policy analyst for Sky TV Australia. He's from the Club of Rome. He's one of the world's intellectuals, and this is an area he's taken great interest in over the years and written on, and particularly in regard to media lately is the stuff I've been reading. In our Melbourne studio, Dean Peter Baker. He's senior lecturer in the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at UNSW Canberra and a researcher in military ethics at the Australian Centre for the Study of Armed Conflict and Society. And in our Brisbane studio, Harlem Rain, who's the Associate Professor of Islamic West Relations in the School of Humanities at Griffith University, and he's been doing lots of interdisciplinary stuff, doing Islamic studies, sociology, international relations, and media. Now, let's just take a couple of calls, because I'm interested to know what the listeners are actually thinking about as we speak. Hello, have I got you there, Dan?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
In South Melbourne, what did you want to say?
Yes, look, I'm just wondering why the Western Christian world is so horrified by the act of beheading. Surely being burnt alive by napalm, as we did to women and children in Vietnam, is worse. Now, in Nanjing, where we have a memorial to the 300,000 Chinese massacred by the Japanese Imperial Army, the use of the samurai sword was really quite humane. They had machines which ground the victim into mincemeat while still alive. Now, why are we, in the Christian West, so horrified by this Muslim act of beheading somebody?
Well, it's interesting. Is it a cultural thing, actually? Do you have something to say, Keith?
Yes, I think it goes back partly to the role of the media, in the sense that, as Stalin, I think, said that if you kill one, it's a tragedy. If you kill a million, it's a statistic. And the fact is that the rape of Nanjing in the 1930s, which the Japanese still deny, is something which it's just too big for us to comprehend. Whereas having somebody burnt alive, like that Jordanian pilot was killed by the Islamic State, that stays in our mind, or the beheadings as well.
As an act of terrorism in theatre, though.
And that's theatre, remember? And that's exactly what Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi said he would do. When he got a chance to run a guerrilla campaign, that's what he would do, and we have fallen for it, hook, line and sinker. The numbers of people actually being killed would be quite small, but they're dying in a very brutal way.
Maximum effect. That, of course, reminds me, you know, if you go back to the Reformation and you think of Tyburn or you think of Cranmer being burnt, these were public displays. They were meant to terrorise. That's what they were meant to do. And we're seeing a very modern version of that now with YouTube and phones. And in fact, it almost seems to me, Keith Suter, that you might like the media to be very careful in what it reports.
That's exactly what Mrs. Thatcher said. I go back to her speech to the American Bar Association, which I happened to be there to hear in London, where she said, the media give oxygen to terrorists, therefore the media should be much more careful how they report on the terrorist activities. In the same way the media already are careful about how they report on suicide.
For fear of copycat and fear of worry. Yes, of course. Look, thank you very much for your call, Dan. I hope that helped.
That's great. Thank you.
And I'm going to go on to John. Have I got you?
Yes, you have.
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, look, first of all, Noel, terrific discussion and compliments to your guest. It's good to hear people who are so well informed.
They're pretty brainy, aren't they? I'm feeling a bit inadequate here, but anyway.
Well, me too, but it's just great to hear, you know, the whole sort of the holistic approach to knowing their history and the facts and between Keith and his colleagues. It's really terrific, so thank you very much to them. Keith, probably more to you, but anybody else could comment if they wanted to. I heard a documentary earlier this year, an American guy, I think it was a BBC production, radio production, talking about, I haven't had a chance to follow it up, and I thought they were talking about some fairly recent releases of White House tapes with Lyndon Baines Johnson, combined with some other research that this guy had done, talking to players during the period of the Vietnam War, which showed that the whole thing was a concoction to allow, sadly and tragically, ironically, for Lyndon Baines Johnson to get his deal through for removing a lot of race discrimination in the South.
You're suggesting it was a distraction, is what you're suggesting, are you? We're just trying to hear clearly because we've got very limited time, but what's the main point you want to make?
My main point, really, Keith, is, are you aware of what I'm talking about, and is that sort of roughly true or right, or have I got it right?
No, I don't think you have. What has caused the scandal has been the release of information showing how Richard Nixon, in the 1968 election, actually delayed any negotiations on settling the Vietnam War so that he could get elected in November. And that's the information that's come out of the library.
Right, yeah, no, mine was different. Anyway, good on you.
Look, thanks, John. Thanks for calling. Thank you. Let's go to, I think, Greg, have I got you?
Yes, you have.
Greg, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I was just wondering, this ISIS group and the other terrorist groups you're talking about, like, even if you go to war and you manage to stop them, how do you stop the splintering groups, like the smaller factions coming up and starting all over again? You're never going to stop it.
Halim, maybe you'd like to say something?
Yeah, look, it's an excellent question. It's a very good point. I think it has to go back. There needs to be a long-term strategy here, and we've seen groups like this coming into being and increasingly so over the last few decades. I think we have to look at the kind of ideology that has come to, that has basically taken Islam hostage. And we have to look at where that ideology originates from. You know, we had Saudi Arabia here for the G20 not so long ago, and the discussions focused on issues around ISIS and so forth. But I don't think anybody cared to look down the end of the table at Saudi Arabia and say, you know, what are you doing about this? You must bear some responsibility, because at the end of the day, the Salafist ideology of ISIS is identical, is a reflection of the Wahhabist ideology, the Salafist ideology that you get out of Saudi Arabia.
Keith is nodding again here.
The kinds of actions that they're doing, the destruction of cultural heritage, it's the slavery, the beheadings, the massacres, etc. I mean, this is all out of the Saudi
objects.
This is all out of the Saudi playbook, if you like, but this is all endorsed in by their interpretation of Islam, and something needs to be done about that, and something needs to be done about the fact that they are able to export that globally. I mean, people right here in Australia have ideas that are consistent with those shared by terrorist groups within ISIS. And this is a consequence of a type of education that's been allowed to flourish around the Muslim world.
Well, Harlem, can I ask you, though, what's on the table this week is the possibility of entering into war. Now, what would be the response to these splinter groups, in your view? What's the best way to go about it? Is it foreign aid, like Keith has said?
At the beginning of the program, we spoke about kind of apocalyptic ideas about...
The dramatic
ideas. Hmm. That's right. This Islam fighting against Rome, as you put it, or the West. And we're playing into their hands if we're going to go along with, these kinds of ideas of going and bombing. And the bombing is most likely to be very ineffective, but it will be a very useful propaganda tool for ISIS, for sure.
Look, thank you very much for your call, Greg. I have to say, though, that I imagine it must upset a whole lot of Protestants whenever ISIS claims that it's going to march only to Rome, as if the Protestants don't exist. But look, there you go. Perhaps we could go to Ron. Have we got you there?
At the end of the Desert Storm, the general who chased the Iraqis out of Kuwait, he refused to go on. My understanding was because he said, "Well, if we take out Saddam Hussein, who takes over?"
That's right.
And I think in Turkey earlier this year, Mr. Putin said the same thing about Syria. All right, if you take out leadership, who takes over? And it seems really weird that we got this strange idea that we will somehow transplant this so-called Western democracy on these countries. And it just doesn't work, does it? It's crazy stuff.
Well, look, thank you very much for your call. Dean, perhaps I could bring you in there. Is that what we're after? Western democracy, do you think?
Yeah, well, I had to think there again of the Libya case. Same sort of situation where we thought, well, Gaddafi's a bad guy, we've got to take him out. But we didn't really have an end goal. And it comes back to this question of the likelihood of success. So although...
Can I add also, I've had Iraqi friends say to me, look, the one thing Saddam did was he held the country together.
Right.
They often say this,
Yeah. So we have to be very careful of unintended consequences when we get involved and start throwing bombs around. What I think comes out of, yes, it's true that we are having fewer and fewer state versus state conflicts, although we keep coming back to states and wanting to say, well, could the Saudis sort this out? But the reality is the world is different now, and states are no longer have as central a role as they have historically. Mm. We just have a much more complex situation, which means we have to rethink what success looks like. Is it defeat? Can we roll in and defeat them? That's what we grew up with, these great war stories of rolling in and defeating the enemy, and that was the end of it. Mm. I'm not sure success looks like that anymore.
Well, look, we've only got 6 minutes to go. Like we always run out of time. We could go on for 2 hours, and there's just so much more I want to ask each of the three of you. But in the 6 minutes we've got, I'd like to return to the original question that we started on. Now, Syria and ISIS. Syria is in a dreadful state. We're a wealthy country. We're an organised country. Despite whatever budget crises we may have had, we are still an organised country compared to many others. We're allied to the United States. We're allied with Europe. In the situation of Syria, where we're hearing unspeakable things, we've heard appeals from religious leaders to intervene. Some said don't intervene. We've got refugees everywhere. Looking at that one thing, and the Prime Minister has suggested we should be involved in putting troops on the ground, if you look at it in terms of just war theory, where should we be thinking in each of your views? And can I begin with you, Keith Souter?
Well, I don't think you can make a just war argument out in favour of getting involved in Syria. There are two things, by the way, we've got to be careful. The Prime Minister has talked about having our planes currently in Iraq bombing Syria.
Yes.
No one's talking about boots on the ground at the moment. The Americans certainly are not. But I just can't see how you can reconcile whatever interpretation of just war theory you choose, because there are a variety of them, to justify our getting involved in Syria. And as I say, I think the primary motivation is more domestic politics rather than actually trying to assist countries. If we really want to help the Syrians, then we should help them in resettlement. We should give much more foreign aid. We're actually cutting back on our foreign aid. We should be a lot more generous. As you say, we're a rich country. We should be giving more foreign aid, not only here but elsewhere.
So just to follow up again, Keith, in a sense you're talking about theatre here again, a different type of theatre, which is political theatre, not the theatre of terrorism.
That's right.
But you're suggesting this could be about, you know, shoring up domestic support inside
and being seen to be tough, and that's and because that's how he improves his standing in the ratings. And so,
as any politician does,
as every politician does. It seems to me that if we can find money for war, we can find money for peace, and we should be looking at this in doing things differently, not just thinking you've got to keep bombing people. At the moment, the Canadians are there; they haven't got enough targets to bomb in Syria. So it's not as though the Americans are really pushing us to get involved. We have a prime minister who wants to get involved, and I don't think the justification is there.
What is the plan, as it were? What exactly are we getting involved in? Halim, can I go to you? Could you give us a view?
I think we need to consider the way ISIS operates, and once we do that, we'll realise that bombing will be very ineffective against this particular type of enemy.
Keith's nodding again.
And I think we need to consider, you know, the amount of money that we would spend being involved in that war. If we were to spend a fraction of that, we would be able to do, you know, an extraordinary amount to help the refugees, the Syrian people, you know, who are in dire need at the moment. And if, you know, if we've got money to spend, then I think that it should be directed towards helping those people rather than some useless pursuit that is only really going to play into the hands of ISIS at the end of the day.
And make us a target, presumably, too. More of a target, anyway. Well, Dean, can I go to you? I feel that I've invited accidentally an entirely peace-loving team here. Do you see any justification?
I wouldn't close the door completely, but I think
there's wriggle room. That's good.
Well, what both Keith and Halim are saying is entirely fitting with the just war tradition. One of the things we haven't mentioned is the idea of last resort, and that is that the use of force should be only used when there is nothing else that can be reasonably considered to actually improve the situation. And I don't know enough about the realities on the ground. I don't have access to the government's intelligence reports, but that's the real question, right? Is there something else we could be doing? Bombing, even with precision weapons, is always going to cause a lot of damage. Is that really the last resort that we have available to us?
Well, here's the last question, then. We've got only a short point to do this. You mentioned, you know, I don't have access to the government's intelligence. Now, Keith, you've actually worked in some of these areas yourself. The declaration of war, or the way we do war, or conflict, in America, in Australia, it's different the way it's done. And it seems at the moment the Prime Minister could make a decision, not have a plebiscite, but simply say, we're going to get involved in this conflict. That is our system, isn't it?
That is the act of the sovereign, yes. So the Australian government has that right. The Americans have it a little more complicated. You need some advice and consent of the Senate. So it's a little more complicated there. But the Australian government could go ahead and start conducting those bombing operations. It would be highly unwise, in my view.
And Dean, I gather you would agree with that?
I think so, yeah. Look, I think that there are things we can do that fall short of us actually getting involved and hurting people, where we can support people on the ground who are actually going to be able to make some long-term difference.
Final comment, Halim.
I think that we need to start holding our politicians to account for sending our young men and women off to war. We need to reflect on the wars that they've most recently been involved in, what have been the outcomes and the consequences of those. I don't think we'd be having this conversation about ISIS tonight if the Americans didn't, and we also followed them into that war against Iraq in 2000, or the invasion and occupation of Iraq in 2003.
Seemed right at the time, according to the intelligence we were given, though, didn't it?
No, it's not. No, you shouldn't say that. No. Don't blame the intelligence. It's the politicians you should blame.
That's right. Bottom line, I think that we should be holding our politicians to account, and they should know that there are consequences if they deceive the public and take us into a war that we should never have been involved in.
And we should have an inquiry as to why Australia went in 2003, just as the British have been doing.
Absolutely. And I think that if we were to do that, you know, our politicians would be probably more reluctant to, or they wouldn't be jumping at the chance
strong
to go to war
words
so
from
quickly.
I've got to go because you've only got 8 seconds to go. Dr. Keith Suter, Dean Peter Baker, Halim Rain, I want to thank you all for being part of a very stimulating and challenging discussion.